Good morning. This is Focus 580, hour number two of our program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. We're here weekday mornings 10 until noon with 10 different topics every week. And if you'd like to check the schedule, look at our database of archives so you can listen to some programs that you might have missed, or you'd like to go back and hear some again, or you want to sign up for our podcasts, any and all of that you can do by going to our website, which is will.illinois.edu. Well, last month, folks around the Midwest were reminded that while they are certainly not common, earthquakes are possible in our part of the country. People in parts of 16 states said that they felt this quake on the 18th of April, which originated on the Wabash Valley Fault, that is located some 120 miles east of St. Louis. Now, probably people are more used to hearing about and thinking about the New Madrid Fault as being a place where there could be seismic activity here in this part of the country. And if you had a big quake there, it certainly would be felt here and could cause significant damage, depending on where you were. There are some scientists now who say that this particular fault that where this quake occurred, the Wabash Valley Fault, maybe is something that we should be paying attention to and potentially could be more problematic than the better-known New Madrid Fault. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about earthquakes generally and maybe specifically here in this part of the country. And our guest is Douglas Weens. He is a professor of geological sciences in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Washington University, and that's in St. Louis. He's talking with us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions, comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and if it would be a long-distance call, you're listening over the air around Illinois, Indiana, anywhere that signal will travel, or anywhere across the country if you're listening on the Internet, use the toll-free line, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Professor Weens, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us. We appreciate it.
I'm glad to be here today.
Let's talk a little bit about this quake. This may be for some people, I don't know if they'd say that was the first quake that they experienced. It is not all that common around here, and I know a lot of people were either they were up or they were awakened with the feeling that things were shaken. This was on the 18th of April. Tell us just a little bit about what happened on the April 18th.
Well, it was a moderate-sized earthquake, magnitude 5.2, along the Wabash Valley Fault, near the border, actually, of Illinois and Indiana. And essentially what was happening is one part of the earth was sliding horizontally past another part. And that's what caused the earthquake.
This is something that I'm sure that people don't, you know, probably if you ask them, well, what's going on when an earthquake occurs, I think most people would say, well, I'm not exactly sure. They're a little bit confused. I mean, they know about what it feels like, but what is really going on under the surface, I think they're, people would say, well, you know, I guess I'm not really exactly sure what happens. Is it now? And unfortunately, here we have no diagram, so we can't show people what it is we're talking about. Is it possible to explain in a general kind of way what is going on that then creates the thing that we feel?
Well, it's there's a fault or essentially a break in the rocks deep in the earth. This earthquake, I believe, was something like about 8 miles deep or so. So it's not right near the Earth's surface, but it's some ways down. And the rock will slip along this crack because of stresses that have built up over a period of time. And so the area that actually moves in an earthquake of this magnitude, 5.2, is not real large, maybe several miles. The fault might be several miles long, and it might move maybe only a few inches. But that amount of movement will give, you know, gives rise to all the vibrations, and it's the vibrations of the earth moving out from the fault that you feel, and that actually, if the earthquake was a bit larger, would cause the damage and destruction.
Mm-hmm. And this kind of movement, I gather, can occur in various kinds of ways. That is, that it could be a sideways movement. It could be one part could actually move up. So the potential for the different kinds of movement, maybe what you feel is going to be the same thing, but what's going on with the two masses and what happens along that fault can occur in different sorts of ways.
That's true. This particular earthquake, one side of the fault was moving pretty much horizontally with respect to the other side of the fault. But there are, like you mentioned, other kinds of earthquakes. Should just an average person, you know, being woken up by the vibrations of the earthquake, you won't really be able to tell the difference. But for us scientists who record the earthquakes, we can kind of back that information out of the records that we record.
Well, does that give you some valuable sorts of information in trying to understand what's happening along this fault and maybe to make some kinds of forecasts or predictions about what's likely to happen in the future?
Well, it does help us to understand how the fault is related to the geology of the area and how it's related to the stress buildup in the earth. It doesn't really allow us to say anything about how soon, you know, there might be another earthquake, in terms of days or years or tens of years, hundreds of years. So I guess, you know, it helps us a lot in a scientific sense, but maybe not in terms of, the kind of information that people might want to have in terms of predictions.
Well, I want to come back to this business of predictions, but I tell you, we have a caller here and someone on a cell phone, so I won't make them wait. We'll get right there, and this is line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
On that earthquake, I live in Charleston, and I've been in a lot of earthquakes because I used to live in California. And there's always been a noise and a rumble, and I heard nothing. There was no sound. Other people in Charleston had sound. Now, why did I not have sound?
Well, I think that basically whether you hear sound or not depends on what kind of a house you're in, and if there's things that will be rattling in your house. So in St. Louis here, I heard sound because the mirror in our bedroom isn't attached very well, and it was just rattling and banging around. So there's actually quite a bit of sound, where I was at, but it just kind of depends on what your house is like and what kinds of things are loose and might be rattling around.
Well, the deep rumble that people often report with an earthquake, which I've heard in many earthquakes, is that from the house or from the ground?
Well, I believe, at least in most cases, that it's from the house or the neighbor's houses or other things that are on the surface of the earth that are moving. I suppose it could be from vibrations affecting trees or things like that also. Basically what's happening with the earthquake is the ground, of course, is vibrating. And so, if that's causing things on the earth's surface to vibrate, then you're going to hear sound from that.
Okay. Thanks.
All right, thanks. So what I hear you saying is that if you were at the site of an earthquake and it was out in an open area and that there weren't structures around, that sounds as if there would not be a lot of sound. There would not be an audible kind of, you might think that there would be a rumbling of the earth, but apparently that doesn't really happen.
Well, if you were at an earthquake where the fault really came right up to the surface, like the San Andreas Fault in California, it's possible that you would hear some noise right from the fault itself, and there have been those kind of reports. But this particular fault in the Wabash Valley didn't come up to the surface. So I think most of the noises that people heard, and most of us were far enough away that we wouldn't hear the noise from the earthquake itself. So for most of us, we were hearing the noise caused by the vibrations.
Yeah. Well, that, certainly that was my experience in our bedroom. We had something sitting on top of a dresser that the floor is a little unsteady, so anytime you walk by, it rattles. Well, here I was awakened by this rattling, and I knew there was nobody walking around, and I guess that was the first thing that said to me something was going on. And then I think I would have said that that there was also a shaking that I could actually feel. Maybe not real dramatic, but enough so that I felt like in this my sort of groggy state where I was awakened, I thought, is this an earthquake? And only found out later that, in fact, that it was.
Yeah, I think that's the kind of experience most of us had. My wife started yelling, "What's going on?" And I said I thought it was an earthquake.
And she figured, well, you should, of anybody, you should be able to say, yes, that's what it is.
Yeah, I was sure it was an earthquake, and so, you know, I ran over to my computer and started looking to see what kind of reports were coming in, because I was very curious where it had happened.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that people will know about the New Madrid Fault, maybe a while before since anybody really thought about that, but it was, I don't know now how many years ago it was, that it was much in the news because there was someone who had made this prediction that there was going to be a big quake, and that time came and went, and so people went on to think about other things. Just remind us about the New Madrid Fault and where that is.
The New Madrid Fault is right about where the states of Arkansas, Tennessee, and Missouri come together. So, and it's just so in Missouri we call it the Boot Heel area of Missouri. So it's quite a bit south of the St. Louis area. And the concern, you know, the reason New Madrid is in the news a lot is because in 1811 and 1812, there were three extremely large earthquakes there. And because of those three really large earthquakes, we know that fault has the capability of producing, you know, really large damaging earthquakes. Of course, in 1811, 1812, there weren't, this area was not heavily settled, so the damage was not as extensive as it would be now.
Well, that, and again, indeed, that is the concern now, that apparently if you had a quake of that scale now, you could expect serious damage in places like Memphis and St. Louis. And so those maybe would be the biggest cities that would be close enough to be affected. But the potential for some damage to occur is considerable, and that was one of the reasons that there was indeed so much concern about this particular prediction, and also generally just, I think, people in your business just want the folks who are in this area to be aware that that's the kind of, that the potential for that does indeed exist.
Well, that's true, and the earthquake in China is sort of a reminder, I guess, that if people do not keep good construction standards and do not remember that earthquakes are a significant hazard, then you can have tremendous loss of life from an earthquake.
Is there a good way of calculating, obviously here the people would like you to be able to say, well, I can tell you exactly when it's going to happen, and that's just not something that you can do. But the odds apparently are that in a given period of time, you would expect that there could well be a significant earthquake, say, on that fault or the one where this last quake occurred. Is there any way to put a number on that that's useful at all, or is it just something like that says, well, within the next 100 years or more, we could have a quake, but I can't tell you when, and it might even not occur?
Well, there's a lot of debate among scientists, actually, as to how frequently large earthquakes should be expected on these faults in the Midwest, including the New Madrid Fault and the Wabash Valley Fault. The problem is, unlike California, in California you can actually measure the rate of motion between the western side of the San Andreas Fault and the eastern side using something like GPS. It's a similar thing to the GPS handheld things that you use when you go hiking or that you have in your car.
Mm-hmm.
Only these are really, really accurate. And so over a period of years, you can measure how fast one side of the fault is moving relative to the other side, and then you know how much stress has built up on the fault. And that gives some idea of how often to expect a really large earthquake in California, even if we can't predict that there will be one here necessarily in a given year or even a given decade. In the Midwest, the problem is that when we do these kind of measurements, we find almost no motion, which is in a way kind of reassuring because it suggests that there isn't nearly the level of earthquake hazard here that you would have in California. But on the other hand, it leaves us quite a bit in the dark as to how often an earthquake like the 1811-1812 earthquake should happen. And so there's various estimates then of how often those kind of earthquakes should happen, and they vary quite a lot.
We have some other callers to talk with. Let's do that and go to next someone in Coles County on line 4. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
I have a couple questions. Are these Midwestern horizontal slippages related to continental drift? And the second question is, are these faults date back to the formation and breakup of the supercontinent Pangaea? I'll hang up and listen.
All right.
Well, those are really good questions. The faults in the Midwest are not part of plate tectonics like the San Andreas Fault. The San Andreas Fault in California is actually the boundary between two big plates, the North American plate and the Pacific plate, and that's why there's a lot of slip there. The faults in the Midwest are on the inside, we call it intraplate, on the inside of the North American plate, and so there's no motion between two different plates here. What we think is happening is that there are stresses that build up in the North American plate from the motion of North America over the Earth's interior, and those stresses are probably what is, or maybe what's contributing to these earthquakes on the interior of the plate. It's thought that at least the New Madrid faults are related to very, very old faults or zones of weaknesses from the breakup of from a previous tectonics that was going on, or previous motions that were going on. At one point, the area, essentially the Mississippi Delta area or the lower Mississippi area, was starting to move apart, and then movement stopped, but it left faults in this area. And so that's probably what formed the faults originally, but it's not what is causing the earthquakes today.
And is this something that goes, there is this idea that if you go back far enough in the history of the Earth, that the land masses of all that make up all the continents were all one piece of one big piece, and that they then came apart and drifted off into their present positions. The kind of thing that we're talking about here, these underlying structures, go all the way back that far?
Yes, they do. Yeah, mm-hmm. Or even before the last supercontinent formation. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's talk with someone in Oakwood. This is line 1. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Yeah, this is kind of an off-the-wall question. I just wondered if by any chance you were familiar with a short story, I'm going to date myself here, back from 1963 called The Great Nebraskan Sea by Alan Danzig.
No, I'm sorry. I'm not familiar with it. Sounds interesting, but I'm not familiar with that story.
Well, what is the basic story of the Great Nebraskan Sea?
Well, the Great Nebraskan Sea, we lost approximately 8 states. There's a fault, I guess it's in Colorado, called the Kiowa Fault. And it gave way and caused a chain reaction, and you ended up with the Great Nebraskan Sea, the White Cliffs of Colorado, the Ozark Islands, the 3-degree Memphis tilt. And let's see, one line I can remember was the governor of Kansas went down with his state.
Well, sounds like an interesting piece of fiction, but certainly not related to anything in reality.
I'm glad to hear that. Okay, thank you very much.
Don't have to worry about an ocean suddenly appearing in the middle of the continental U.S. Next caller here is in Urbana, line number 2. Hello.
Yes, I'm wondering, what is the probability of destructive earthquake damage in this area? Is it such that people should think about insurance?
Well, I think people's approach to insurance, has to do maybe with your how you want to approach risk, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously the level of earthquake hazard in a place like Urbana is not real high. The nearest I do believe that the Wabash Valley Fault is probably the main source of concern that you would have in Urbana, but obviously there isn't a recorded destructive earthquake on Wabash Valley since Europeans settled that area. So we know for like 250 years or so there hasn't been a really large earthquake there. So I guess if you're willing to take some small amount of risk, you'd say that the danger is not real high. There's obviously some possibility of earthquake damage in Urbana. If you had some of the studies of the soil in the Wabash Valley area show that there have been magnitude 6.5 or even magnitude 7 earthquakes there in the past, and if that happened, there would be some damage in Urbana. But it's not real likely to happen in your lifetime.
Mm-hmm. The insurance companies are beginning to push earthquake insurance. I suppose it's much more profitable to them to sell earthquake insurance where it won't happen.
Well, that is probably true. I know it's very expensive and difficult to get in some parts of California, for example, where the likelihood of damage is a lot higher. So, yeah.
What would the damage to a home have been that is a two-story or one-story home? Would the earthquake of the New Madras Fault, if there had been homes here at that time?
Well, it would be kind of interesting, I guess, to look at the historical records from that, because I don't know about Urbana itself, but there were certainly in 1811 some homes at various places around Indiana and Illinois. We know that there was in St. Louis, for example, there was some damage, but it wasn't catastrophic damage. There were brick structures that were damaged, and that was for. And I guess I should say that there's a disagreement about the exact size of the New Madrid earthquakes. Various estimates, I guess, usually center around 7.5 to 8.0, but there are a few people that think that they might have been smaller than 7.5, and there's some people that think that they were larger than 8.0. The problem is we didn't have any seismographs at the time. That was before the seismograph was invented. So I guess I don't know if that's a kind of a long, rambling answer to your question, but, you know, it's not clear to me that there would be major damage in Urbana from those earthquakes because of the distance.
Well, that's what I was thinking. It's about 300 miles to the New Madras Fault. Not quite that far to the Wabash, but still well over 200.
Yeah, I think the Wabash Valley area would be considerably closer and would be probably the more likely source of damage in Urbana.
What would be the effects on buildings like the Sears Tower in Chicago? Not much of anything?
Well, in general, I think the damage, we always think of the tallest skyscrapers as being the most dangerous,
mm-hmm.
but in an earthquake, typically you may have more damage in, you know, say, three-story unreinforced masonry buildings than you would have in tall skyscrapers in many cases, because the skyscrapers have a lot of steel, and steel is to some extent flexible. If you've ever been up the Sears Tower on a really windy day, I don't know if you can actually notice it, but
yes, you can.
Yeah, it actually is made to flex in the wind, and so that actually, you know, is something that's very valuable if there is an earthquake. Whereas the worst kind of building that you can have is one that's made out of brick or concrete without adequate steel reinforcing.
I suppose brick veneers and such would also be subject to damage.
Brick veneer is subject to damage, but because the structure is wood or some other material, they're not likely to totally collapse.
Mm-hmm.
So well, they're kind of an intermediate level of damage, I guess.
I'm finding your talk very interesting, and thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. We are a little bit past the midpoint here. Perhaps I should introduce again our guest, Douglas Weens. He's professor of geological sciences in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. And we're talking about earthquakes in Illinois and elsewhere. Questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just for a second, and I've got some other callers I want to get back to, just for a second to go back to the big quakes that happened, this was in 1811, 1812, on the New Madras Fault, and that the fact that big quakes did happen there at one time, that says that we could have a big quake there again, and that could cause significant damage in the Midwest. But it is, as it's my understanding, as you and the caller were discussing, that there are, among seismologists and geologists, there's apparently some disagreement about those particular quakes and just how significant they were, because as you say, we're just making some kind of educated guesses about what the magnitude was.
Well, there's no doubt they were significant, but trying to put them on the modern scale of magnitudes is not very easy, because, I mean, partly because there haven't been any really large earthquakes, fortunately, in the Midwest since the seismograph was really, you know, become into wide-scale use. The last big one was in, I believe it was the mid-1890s, and it's estimated at about 6.2 or 6.5. So there isn't anything that we can use to, any modern earthquake that we can use to compare to the 1811, 1812 earthquakes to calibrate it relative to the magnitude scale.
Mm-hmm.
And so the only way that people can really study the size of those earthquakes is by reading newspaper reports and people's diaries and so forth as to the level of damage. And, of course, building standards have changed, and to some extent reporting standards have changed since 1811 on the frontier. So there's a little bit of interpretation involved.
All right, let's talk with some other callers here. And next we'll talk with someone in here in Champaign County where we are, line three. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
The Wabash earthquake occurred about 8 miles down, he said. Do you have any idea how thick the earth crust is here in the Midwest? Thank you.
Yes, the crust, which when we as geologists, geophysicists say crust, we're referring to the area of less dense rock on the top of the mantle, which is more dense, and that's about 40 kilometers thick, so that would be about something like 20 to 25 miles, I guess 25 miles thick in this area. But if by crust you mean the rigid part of the earth, that would be thicker. It would go down, oh, maybe 50 miles or so.
Well, I hope that gets at the caller's question. Let's go to Sycamore up in the northern part of the state for another caller here, line four. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I'm going to touch on the same subject as two callers ago. I'd be interested in knowing your thoughts on how much damage to brick structures, say one-story brick structures, in the Chicago area would be if another quake of that magnitude, like 1811, hit again today. That's probably about 300 miles away. And I gather that quake energy travels more efficiently in the Midwest than it does out in California.
Well, to address your last comment first, that's certainly true. An earthquake like this 5.2 magnitude earthquake that we had just a month ago was felt over, I don't know, people said something like 15 states. A 5.2 earthquake in California would probably hardly be felt more than 100 miles away from the epicenter. So that's an illustration of how much more efficiently the vibrations travel in the Midwest. I think there's probably a little bit of uncertainty about whether there'd be some damage in Chicago from a large New Madrid earthquake, but it would undoubtedly be quite light just because of the distance away. So it would be on the order of maybe cracks and in buildings and chimneys being damaged or falling rather than sort of major damage.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana and toll-free 800-222-9455. This quake that the recent one, the reason that we're doing this, the one that took place on April 18th, was on this fault, the Wabash Valley Fault, and not quite as well known as the other that we talked about, the one that certainly was in the news going back now, I'm not even sure how many years this was, when it was, there were these predictions about a quake on the New Madrid Fault. So that one is one that people, I'm sure, have heard about, maybe not everybody, maybe almost nobody has heard of the Wabash Valley Fault. Are there, in fact, others around this same particular area? As it seems to me that while the Wabash Valley Fault is a little closer to us where we are right here, that it's still kind of in the same general area that we're talking about here. And is there some particular reason that this area we're talking about that's kind of at the point where you know, Arkansas and Missouri and Tennessee and Kentucky kind of all and a little bit of southern Illinois sort of all come together?
Well, first of all, there are faults everywhere in the crust. Almost everywhere you as a geologist might look, there are some faults. The real question is the active faults. And even in terms of active faults, there are small earthquakes can pop up, you know, in a wide variety of places. There's been several small earthquakes in recorded history in northern Illinois just a couple of weeks ago. weeks ago, we had a magnitude 2.5 earthquake here in the St. Louis suburban area, which kind of surprised people. So there's a wide variety of faults and small faults. The question, I think, is where are the sort of large faults that can and that are active that can produce a really large earthquake? So, you know, it looks like we know that the Wabash Valley Fault can produce large earthquakes because of the studies I was mentioning, and also just because we've had several fairly significant, well, I shouldn't say significant, but magnitude 5 like earthquakes there over the past few decades. And I forget your other question that related to how the New Madrid Fault was related to the Wabash Valley Fault.
Well, I guess it seemed to me that it's relatively speaking kind of in the same area, and I was wondering, well, is there something about this particular area that makes it prone to significant faults, those where you could have seismic activity that could cause a lot of damage. This particular region, it seems to be, again, as I said, sort of in that place where these states, Missouri, Arkansas, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Illinois all kind of meet.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a thought that the Wabash Valley Fault is perhaps related to the New Madrid Fault, if not exactly connected to the New Madrid Fault specifically. So there may be a belt or a sort of a larger region which has a higher potential for earthquakes that would include the Wabash Valley Fault area and the New Madrid area.
Is this an area that in relatively recent times, that is within the last few decades, is getting more attention in the sense that seismologists are paying attention to what's going on, making some effort to monitor and to try to perhaps get a better understanding of what's going on in this particular part of the country?
I think so. I mean, you know, to some extent we've known about the earthquake hazard here since 1811, but, you know, it's only in the last, number of decades that we've had good instruments out here to measure these earthquakes. And also, you know, then there's been attention that's been placed on building standards, which is good, because you don't want very, you know, really shoddy buildings to be constructed in an area where there might be earthquakes. That seems to have been the case in China, leading to the large loss of life there. So, maybe in response to what you're saying, it's not really that the hazard is increased. We have no evidence that the hazard is really increased relative to previously, but there is more attention being given to it because we have better recordings of it, and because people, I think, are just more aware.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked a little earlier about how, for example, in California, it is possible to monitor movements along the San Andreas Fault and apparently to monitor them with a very high degree of precision, so that you could, even a small movement over time, you could track small movements that would indicate to you where along the fault stress is building up and then where it might be likely that there would be an earthquake. Is it, and I'm sure that the thing that people always want to know is, well, why is it you can't predict when and where earthquakes are going to occur? Is there, what sort of potential do you think is there for being able to have a better idea, say better monitoring of what's going on in these seismic zones, the Wabash Valley and the New Madrid, that would then at least give you some kind of data, something to work with, as you're trying to understand what the potential is for significant quakes in either of these places?
Well, I think as time goes by and our measurements become more and more precise, we may, using the GPS technology that I was talking about, we may eventually be able to measure the buildup of strain along these faults to some extent. Like I said, so far we have essentially come up with, you know, we know that the values are very small, and but the error bars are still larger than the measurements. So because the values are so small, but so eventually I think over time we may be able to get a better idea there. But I don't know that there will ever be the possibility to actually predict the time and place of an earthquake, you know, in terms of days or years even, which, you know, of course, has been sort of a dream of people for a long time. But mm-hmm. but it could be that there's just, the physics are such that we can't do that.
Let me just quickly mention that our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Douglas Weens. He is a professor of geological sciences in the Department of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Washington University in St. Louis, and is talking with us about earthquakes, particularly earthquakes in this part of the country back in the middle of April. Say, to be precise, this was April 18th. There was an earthquake that people certainly felt here in Champaign-Urbana. In fact, it was felt in something like parts of 16 states around the Midwest. It happened early in the morning, and maybe for a lot of people that might have been their first experience with an earthquake, or one of few that they would have had in their lifetimes. And it gets you thinking about the fact that even though it is maybe not common, it is certainly possible for there to be earthquakes in this part of the country. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. So I understand that you did have the opportunity to go recently to China. I think you didn't actually be able to, you couldn't actually go to where not in Sichuan where the actual earthquake occurred, but you were there in China and did get some sort of a sense about what had happened there and how the government was trying to cope?
Yes, I was in Beijing, China, last week, you know, on a previously scheduled trip that really had nothing to do with the earthquake. But it was very interesting to be there at this time because there is a tremendous effort, I think, now to deal with the earthquake. As I think now the death toll is above 50,000, which is just an incredible tragedy, and you know, the people there are trying to deal with that as best they can. So, for example, on the TV, there was one English language channel, and it really showed the quake response 24 hours a day, you know, 7 days a week. So the entire news story was an entire TV broadcast. Everything else was taken off the air, except for the stories of the quake response. And a lot of the scientists I was talking to were very busy with many meetings with the government to decide things like which areas to rebuild and which areas maybe were dangerous because of landslide danger or something and should be not rebuilt, and how to deal with the aftershocks and so forth. I also talked to several scientists who had been out there and doing some early reconnaissance about evaluating the dangers for landslides and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk with somebody else here, an Urbana caller. This is our line number one. Hello.
Hello, Dr. Weens. I had a question for you. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the type of faulting and the fault orientations. And I was wondering if fault motions on all sorts of faults in the Midwest indicate some common stress that's causing it.
Yes, they do in general. They generally indicate more or less an east-west orientation for compressive stress, sort of like there's pushing, between the eastern and western parts of North America, and that's true for both the Wabash Valley Fault and the New Madrid Fault system. The New Madrid Fault system also mostly has for the most part, the same kind of sliding, in other words, horizontal. But there's one area of the New Madrid Fault system that has the kind where one block is actually sliding over another block. So, but it's all sort of consistent with this general east-west stress pattern.
And the faults are roughly vertical?
Well, the faults where the blocks are sliding past each other are roughly vertical, yes.
Mm-hmm. And did either of these faults have any surface expression that people can see?
No, not really. That's one of the difficulties in studying the faults here, is that because we have such extensive sediments in these river valleys, we don't really have exposures on the surface for geologists to look at. The main features that we can see on the surface are, sort of cracks and in particular sand blows, which are areas where the sand, if it's wet, becomes mobile and flows out on the surface, which indicate previous earthquakes. But we don't actually find the fault itself.
And in that, the large faults, or the large earthquakes on the New Madrid in the early 1800s, was there much vertical displacement, or was it all the motion horizontal?
Well, that's a matter of some speculation, and there were reports of vertical motions from eyewitnesses, stories about the river flowing backwards, and things like that. And so there's quite a bit of discussion about whether, all three of those earthquakes were on the exact same part of the fault, or whether one of the three earthquakes may have been on a different part of the fault. So I guess that's not understood real well, because of the lack of any real seismographs to record that those earthquakes.
Right. Okay, well, thanks very much for your time.
All right, thank you. Let's try and get at least one more caller here in Terre Haute, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Excuse me, this is redundant. I just tuned in. But what's the current status of the idea of tidal, the tides from the sun and the moon moving the magma in the center of the earth to cause earthquakes?
Well, that's a good question, because the tides, if some of you may remember, were the basis for the prediction that generated all the hype back in 1990, when there was this, all the news attention was focused on the New Madrid Fault, and people were worried about an earthquake there. Basically, the large earthquakes around the world don't seem to be triggered by tides at all. And so that was why scientists, for the most part, were discounting that prediction that was made by Ivan Browning and telling people not to pay any attention. But the story had gotten out in the news, and so it generated a lot of interest. So in general, we can investigate those relationships, and there really aren't any relationships with the tides for the large earthquakes, at least.
But there may be for smaller ones?
There's a few localized areas, in an area where there's geysers, or near a volcano or something like that, where a specific area might, the small earthquakes there may show a relationship to tides. But we can't find any relationship for the typical larger earthquakes.
Well, those would be areas where there's less of a buffer of a solidified earth between the magma and the surface.
They seem to be sort of unusual systems that may be particularly sensitive to the tides.
Okay, very interesting. A great program. Thanks.
All right, well, thank you. Just before we go, we were talking a little earlier about China, and one of the things that seems to be the case is that people there are very angry and in an uncharacteristically public way, critical of their government for faulty building standards, particularly for public schools, where there were a devastating and very sad number of children that were killed because the buildings collapsed. Here in this part of the country, where we don't really think about seismic activity that much, but it can occur. I wonder, do you think that we give enough attention to making sure that the buildings that we have here, for example, would be able to take whatever we could reasonably expect might happen in terms of earthquakes?
Well, I know that starting about, I think it was about 20 years ago now, in St. Louis, we have building codes that do take into account earthquakes. Not to the level that they do in California, but they take them into account, and I think that's valid. I think the concern in some of the areas could be buildings that are older. In some cases they may not be built to the standards that would be expected. I don't think we have really any buildings. Well, I shouldn't say that. I don't think the problem is as significant here as it was in China, but I think that is a concern.
Well, there we're going to have to finish. We come to the end of the time. Our thanks to Doug Weins. He's professor of geological sciences at Washington University in St. Louis. Professor Weins, thanks very much.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.